between donating a small sum to a local museum that's fundraising for an important artwork or sending it to tackle hunger in Africa. Which do you choose? The museum or hunger?
Now, Jane.
I admire how the work unfolds rigorously with a variety of different typologies.
A man wearing a corduroy jacket announces, waving his champagne flute at the glass and steel roof in big, sweeping gestures.
A fusion of non-Cartesian infrastructure and social functionality, a woman says earnestly. Lines of desire implied and then denied.
Apart from the jargon, I decide, topping out parties aren't so very different from the gallery openings I went to when I worked in the art world. A lot of people in black, a lot of champagne, a lot of hipster beards and expensive Scandinavian spectacles. Tonight, the occasion is the inauguration of a new concert hall by David Chipperfield. I'm gradually becoming familiar with the names of the best-known British architects: Norman Foster, the late Zaha Hadid, John Pawson, Richard Rogers. Many will be present this evening, Edward has told me. Later, there'll be a firework and laser show visible through the glass roof that will be seen as far away as Kent. I wander through the crowd, champagne glass in hand, eavesdropping. I'm wondering because, although Edward has invited me to accompany him, I'm determined not to be an encumbrance. In any case, it isn't hard to fall into conversation when I want to. The crowd is mostly male, very confident, slightly drunk. More than one person has stopped me and said, "Do I know you?" Or, "Where do you work?" Or simply, "Hello." Seeing Edward looking in my direction, I head back toward him. He turns away from the group he's with. "Thank God," he says quietly. "If I have to listen to one more speech about the importance of programmatic requirements, I think I'll go mad." He looks at me appreciatively. "Has anyone told you you're the most beautiful woman in this room?" "Several people, actually." I'm wearing a backless helmet-length dress, thigh length, cut loose behind so that it moves when I do, coupled with some simple scalloped flats from Chloe. Though not in so many words. He laughs. "Come over here." I follow him behind a low wall. He puts his champagne glass on it, then runs his hand down my hip. "You're wearing panties," he observes. "Yes." "I think you should take them off. They spoil the line." "Don't worry, no one will see." For a moment, I freeze. Then I glance around. No one's looking in our direction. As unobtrusively as I can, I slip out of my panties. When I reach down to pick them up, he puts a hand on my arm. "Wait." His right hand lifts the hem of the dress. "No one will see," he repeats. The hand slides up my thigh, then reaches between my legs. I'm shocked. "Edward, I..." "Don't move," he says softly. His fingers slide back and forth, barely making contact. I feel myself angling against him, craving more pressure. "This isn't me," I think. "I don't do things like this." He circles my clitoris 2-3 times, then without warning, one finger gently slides inside me. He pauses to take the glass from my hand and set it down next to his. Then suddenly he has 2 hands on me, one from the back, 2 fingers sliding in and out, one from the front delving and circling. The noise of the party seems to dim. Breathless, I leave the whole question of whether someone might spot us to him. He's in charge now. Despite the unlikely setting, waves of pleasure start to wash over me.
"Do you want to find somewhere private?" I whisper.
"No," he says simply. His fingers increase their tempo, utterly confident. I feel a climax building. My knees sag and his hands take more of my weight. And then I'm there, juddering and shaking around him. Fireworks flash and flicker. Real fireworks, the laser show that can be seen as far as Kent, I realize as I come back to reality. That's what they're all applauding, thank God, not me. My legs are still shaking as he withdraws his hand and says, "Excuse me, Jane, there are some people over there I have to talk to." He strides over to someone who I'm pretty sure is Britain's most eminent architect, a member of the House of Lords, and with an easy smile offers him his hand. The same hand that, seconds ago, was inside me. I'm still reeling as the party starts to break up. Did we really just do that? Did I really just have an orgasm in a room full of people? Is that who I am now? He takes me to a Japanese restaurant nearby, the sort that has a sushi counter in the middle with a chef standing behind it. The other customers are all Asian, businessmen in dark suits. The chef greets Edward as if he knows him well, bowing and speaking in Japanese. Edward replies in the same language. "I've told him to choose what to serve us," he tells me as we sit down at a table. "It's a mark of respect to trust the itemized judgment."
"Your Japanese seems very fluent."
"I did a building in Tokyo not long ago."
"Yes, I know."
His Japanese skyscraper is an elegant, sensuous helix, a giant drill bit piercing the clouds.
"Was that your first time there?"
I know it wasn't, of course. I watch as he rearranges his chopsticks so they're exactly parallel to each other. "I spent a year there after the death of my wife and child," he answers quietly, and I feel a thrill of excitement at this first tiny glimpse of self-revelation, of intimacy. It wasn't just the place I felt at home with. It was the culture, the emphasis on self-discipline and restraint. In our society, austerity is associated with deprivation and poverty. In Japan, they consider it the highest form of beauty, what they call tsubui.
A waitress brings two bowls of soup. The bowls are made of painted bamboo, so light and small they fit into the hand.
"These bowls, for example," he says, picking one up. "They're old and they don't quite match. That's tsubui."
I take a mouthful of soup. Something wriggles against my tongue. A strange flickering sensation.
"They're alive, by the way," he adds.
"What are?"
I say, startled. "The broth contains tiny shrimp, shiruo, the newborns. The chef throws them in at the very last minute. It's considered a great delicacy."
He gestures at the sushi counter, where the chef bows to us again.
"Chef Atara's specialty is ikizukuri, live seafood. I hope that's all right."
The waitress brings another dish and places it on the table between us. On it is a red snapper, its brilliant copper-colored scales very bright against the strips of white radish. One side of the fish has been sliced neatly into sashimi, all the way down to the backbone. But the creature itself is still alive, its tail curling up like a scorpion's before flapping feebly down again, the mouth gulping, the eye rolling in alarm.
"Oh my God," I say, aghast. "Try some. It's delicious, I assure you."
He reaches out and takes a slice of the pale flesh between his chopsticks.
"Edward, I can't eat this." "No matter. I'll order you something else."
He gestures to the waitress, who's at our side in moments. But the broth in my stomach is suddenly threatening to come back up.
"Newborns." The word starts to hammer in my head. "Jane, are you all right?"
He's looking at me, concerned. I'm not. I'm not.
One of the strange things about grief is the way it ambushes you when you least expect it. Suddenly, I'm back in the maternity unit, holding Isabel, frantically tucking her swaddling cloth around her head like a shawl to keep the last precious remnants of body warmth, my body warmth, from escaping, trying to postpone the moment when her little limbs go cold. I'm looking at her eyes, her tiny closed eyes with their sweet, pouchy eyelids, wondering what colour they are, whether they're blue like mine or dark like her father's. I blink, and the memory's gone, but the dull, leaden weight of failure and despair has coshed me once again, and I sob suddenly into my wrist. Oh my God! Edward smacks his forehead. The Shiruo. How could I be so stupid? He speaks to the waitress in an urgent stream of Japanese, pointing at me and ordering more food. But there's no time for that now. No time for anything at all. Already I'm bolting for the door.
Then, Emma. Thank you for coming, Emma, D.I. Clark says. One sugar, yes? The detective inspector's office is a tiny cubbyhole filled with paperwork and files. There's a framed photograph, quite an old one, showing him in the front row of a rugby team, holding a ridiculously large trophy. The mug of instant coffee he hands me has a picture of Garfield on it, which seems too cheerful for a police station. That's all right, I say nervously. What's it about? D.I. Clark takes a mouthful of his own coffee and sets the mug down on the desk. Next to it is a plate of biscuits, which he pushes toward me. The two men charged in connection with your case have both pleaded not guilty and made bail applications. Regarding the accomplice, Grant Lewis, there's not a lot we can do about that. But the one who raped you, Dion Nelson, may be a different matter. Right, I say, although I don't really see why he's called me in to explain this. It's bad news they're pleading not guilty, of course, but couldn't he have told me over the phone? As the victim, D.I. Clark continues, you're entitled to make a victim personal statement, what the press sometimes calls an impact statement. You can tell the bail hearing how the crime affected you, how you feel about the prospect of Nelson being free until his trial begins. I nod. How do I feel? I don't really feel anything. So long as he goes to prison in the end, that's all that matters. Seeing my lack of enthusiasm, D.I. Clark says gently, the thing is, Emma, Nelson is a clever and violent man. I personally would feel much more comfortable if he were to stay behind bars right now. He wouldn't risk doing it again while he was out on bail, though, would he? I say. Then I see what the D.I. is getting at. You think I could be in danger? I say, staring at him. That he might try to stop me giving evidence. I don't want you getting alarmed, Emma. Thankfully, instances of witness intimidation are very rare, but in cases like this, where the whole thing basically hangs on one person's evidence, it's better to be safe than sorry. What do you want me to do? Write a VPS for the bail hearing. We can give you some pointers, but the more personal it is, the better. He pauses. I should remind you, though, that once your statement's been read to the court, it becomes a legal document. The defense will be entitled to cross-examine you on it when it comes to the trial. Who would read it? Well, it could be the prosecution lawyer, or a police officer, for that matter. But these things are always more powerful if they come directly from the victim. Even judges are only human, and I think you'll make a very strong impression. Just for a moment, D.I. Clark's face softens, and he almost seems to go a little misty-eyed. Then he clears his throat. We'll make an application for special measures. That means you can be screened from Nelson during the hearing. You won't have to look at him when you read your statement, and he won't be able to see you. But he'll be there, I say, listening. D.I. Clark nods. And what will happen if the judge disagrees and he does get bail? Isn't there a chance I'll have made things worse? We'll make sure you're safe, D.I. Clark says reassuringly. It's fortunate, after all, that you've moved. He doesn't know where you live. He fixes me with his kindly, careful gaze. So, Emma, will you write a VPS and read it to the court? This is why I'm here, I realise. He knew that if he just called me, I might have said no. Well, if you think it'll help, I hear myself say. Good girl, he says. Coming from anyone else, that would sound patronising, but his relief is so obvious I don't mind. The hearing will be on Thursday, he adds. So soon? He has a very persistent lawyer, unfortunately. All at the taxpayer's expense, of course. D.I. Clark stands up. I'll get someone to find you an empty interview room. You can start drafting it now.
Now, Jane. A few days after the restaurant episode, two packages arrive. One is a large, thin box bearing the distinctive W of Wanderer in Bond Street. The other's smaller, about the size of a paperback. I lift the bigger one onto the stone table. Despite its size, it weighs almost nothing. Inside, cocooned in tissue paper, is a dress. It drapes itself over my arm, the black fabric flowing silkily to either side. I can tell instantly how sensual and caressing it's going to feel next to my skin. I take it upstairs and try it on. I barely have to do more than lift my arms, and the fabric falls into place around my body. When I turn, the material moves with me, almost playfully. Examining the weave, I see it's cut along the diagonal. It needs a necklace, I find myself thinking, and immediately I guess what's in the smaller package. There's a card written in a beautiful, almost calligraphic hand. Jane, forgive me for being an insensitive fool. Edward. And a clamshell case that opens to reveal, nestled in the velvet interior, a three-row collar of pearls. The pearls aren't large, but they're unusual. Pale cream in colour and not quite round, with an opalescent shimmer deep in the nacre. The exact same colour as the walls of 1 Folgate Street. The necklace looks small. Too small, I think, when I first put it on. It's tight against my throat, and for a moment I feel strangled by the lack of give. So different from the flowing, sensuous dress. But then I look at myself in the mirror, and the combination is stunning. I put my hair up with one hand to see what it looks like. Yes, like that, tumbling to the side. I take a selfie to send Mia. Edward should see this too, I think. I forward the picture to him as well. Nothing to forgive, but thank you. He replies less than a minute later. Good, because I'm 2 minutes away and closing. I walk downstairs and stand in front of the plate glass window, facing the door, positioning myself for maximum effect, waiting for my lover. He takes me over the stone table, still in the dress and the pearl collar, urgent, direct, without preamble or small talk. I've never had a relationship like this before. I've never made love anywhere but a bed before. I've been told I'm self-contained and aloof, and by one man, sexually dull. And yet somehow, here I am, doing this. Afterward, it's as if he comes out of a kind of trance, and the urbane, thoughtful Edward is back in charge. He cooks us some pasta, the sauce nothing more than some green olive oil from an unlabeled bottle, a smear of fresh goat's cheese and plenty of ground pepper. The oil is called Lacrima, he tells me, the first precious tears that rise to the surface when the olives are washed before pressing. He has a couple of bottles sent over from Tuscany every harvest. The pepper is from Tellicherry on the Malabar coast, though sometimes I use Kampot peppercorns from Cambodia. They're milder, but more aromatic. Sex, and good, simple food. Somehow it feels like the height of sophistication. When the pasta has been devoured, he loads the dishwasher and cleans the pans. Only then does he take a document from a leather case.
I brought your metrics. I thought you'd like to know how you're doing.
Did I pass? He doesn't smile.
Well, your aggregate is 80.
What should it be?
There's no real benchmark, but we'd be hoping to see it come down to a 50 or even lower over time.
I can't help feeling criticized. So what am I doing wrong? He scans the document, which I now see consists of rows of numbers like a spreadsheet.
You could do a bit more exercise. A couple of sessions a week should be enough. You've lost some weight since you've been here, but you could probably do with losing a bit more. Your stress levels are generally in the acceptable range. Your speech rate tends to go up when you're on the phone, but that's not uncommon. You're drinking hardly any alcohol, which is good. Temperature, respiration, and kidney function are all fine. Your REM sleep is adequate, and you're spending a healthy amount of time in bed. Most important of all, you have a more positive outlook on life. You have an increasingly high level of personal integrity. You're more disciplined. And you're managing to keep the lime scale off the shower.
He smiles to show that the last bit, at least, is a joke, but I'm breathless with indignation.
You know all that about me?
Of course. If you'd read the terms and conditions properly, none of this would come as a surprise.
My anger evaporates as I realize that this was, after all, what I signed up for. The only reason I'm able to afford 1 Folgate Street in the first place.
This is the future, Jane, he adds. Health and well-being monitored by your domestic environment. If there were any major issues, housekeeper would pick them up long before it occurred to you to see a doctor. These stats allow you to take control of your life.
What if people don't want to be spied on?
They won't be. We only have this specific data on you because we're still in the beta stage. For future users, we'll only ever see general trends, not data relating to individuals.
He stands up.
Work on it,
he says kindly.
See if you get used to it. If you can't, well, that's useful feedback too, and we'll see how we can change the system to make it more acceptable. But everything I've learned tells me you'll soon feel much better about it.
Then, Emma. I'm staring at the notes I've made for my VPS, wondering how to begin, when my phone rings. I glance at the screen. Edward. Hello, Emma. Did you get my message? He sounds amused, even cheerful. What message? The one I left at your office. I'm not at work, I say. I'm at a police station. Is everything all right? Not really, I say. I glance down at my notes. D.I. Clark told me to group the main points under some headings. What he did, how I felt at the time, the effect on my relationship, how I feel now. I stare at what I've written. Disgusted, terrified, ashamed, dirty. Just words. Somehow I never imagined it would come to this. It's not really all right at all, I say. Which police station? West Hampstead. I'll be there in 10 minutes. The phone goes silent, and immediately I feel better, much better, because what I want more than anything else right now is for someone strong and decisive, someone like Edward, to come and pick up my life and rearrange all the pieces for me and somehow make everything work. Emma. Oh, Emma, he says. We're in a cafe off West End Lane. I've been crying. Occasionally, other people shoot us suspicious looks. Who is that girl? What has that man done to make her cry like that? But Edward ignores them. One hand gently covers mine for reassurance. It's a terrible thing to say about something as horrible as this, but I feel special. Edward's concern is totally different from Simon's insecure fury. Edward picks up the draft of my statement. "May I?" he asks. I nod and he reads it, frowning occasionally. "What was the message?" I say. "Oh, that. Just a small gift. Well, two gifts, actually." He lifts a bag that's been sitting beside him. On it is a big, bold W logo. "For me?" I say, amazed. I was going to ask you to accompany me to something very tedious, so I thought the least I could do was to get you something to wear. But you won't be in the mood now. I reach into the bag and take out a clamshell case. "You can open it if you want," he says mildly. Inside the case is a necklace, and not just any necklace. I've always wanted a pearl choker like Audrey Hepburn's in Breakfast at Tiffany's, and here it is. Not identical. There are 3 strings, not 5, and no front cluster, but already I can see how it will fit around my neck like a collar, high and tight. "It's beautiful," I say. I reach for the larger box, but he stops me. "Perhaps not here." "What was the occasion? The one you were going to take me to?" "Some architectural award ceremony. Very dull." "Have you won?" "I believe so, yes." I smile at him, suddenly happy. "I'll go home and change," I say. "I'll come with you," he says. He gets to his feet and whispers in my ear, "because I know that as soon as I see you in that dress, I'm going to want to fuck you in it."
Now, Jane. I wake to find Edward gone. This must be what it's like to have an affair with a married man, I think. The thought gives me some comfort. In France, for example, where people are more relaxed about these things, our relationship would be considered perfectly normal. Mia, of course, is convinced it's going to be another disaster, that he'll never change, that anyone who's managed to be so self-contained for so long can never be anything else. When I demur, she tuts exasperatedly. "Jay, you have this schoolgirl fantasy that you're going to be the one to melt his ice-cold heart, when the truth is he's simply going to break yours." But my heart has already been broken by Isabel, I reflect, and Edward's irregular incursions into my life mean it's easy not to let Mia realize just how serious it's getting with him. And it turns out Edward's right. There is something perfect about 2 people who come together without expectations or demands. I don't have to hear the details of his day or squabble about which one of us is going to take the rubbish out. There are no joint schedules to negotiate, no domestic routines to slip into. We never spend long enough together to get bored. Yesterday, he gave me my first orgasm before he'd even taken off his clothes. That's something he likes, I've noticed. To stay fully dressed while he peels my clothes off, everything but the necklace, and reduce me to a quivering wreck with fingers and tongue. As if it's not enough for him to retain control, I have to lose it too. Only then does he feel comfortable letting go himself. That feels like an interesting insight about him, and I'm still mulling it over as I come downstairs. There's a small pile of damp mail on the doorstep. I've asked Edward why there's no letterbox here. It seems a strange oversight in what is generally such a well-thought-out house. And he told me that when 1 Folgate Street was built, his partner, David Teal, was predicting that email would have replaced physical letters altogether within a decade. I glance through them. They're mostly political circulars to do with the upcoming local elections. I doubt I'll even register to vote. Debates about the local library and the frequency of garbage collections have little relevance to my life at 1 Folgate Street. A couple of the letters are addressed to Ms. Emma Matthews,
They're clearly junk, but I put them aside anyway to send on to Camilla, the agent. The last letter is addressed to me. The outside looks so bland that at first I assume it's just more junk mail. Then I see the logo of the hospital trust, and my heart skips a beat. Dear Ms. Cavendish, post-mortem results, Isabel Margaret Cavendish, deceased. I agreed to a post-mortem because it seemed right to try to get some answers. Dr. Gifford told me when I went for my follow-up appointment that it hadn't revealed anything, but I'd be sent a note of the findings anyway. That was a month ago. The letter must have been stuck in the system since then. I sit down, my head swimming, and go through it twice, trying to understand the medical jargon. It starts with a brief history of my pregnancy. There's a reference to the time, a week before they realized something was wrong, when I'd had back pain and taken myself to the maternity unit for a checkup. They'd done some tests, listened to the baby's heartbeat, then sent me home to have a hot bath. I'd felt Isabel kicking quite actively after that, so I'd been reassured. The letter makes it clear that correct procedures were followed on that occasion, including a symphysis fundal height assessment in accordance with NICE guidelines. Then there's a description of my subsequent visit, when they discovered Isabel's heart had stopped. And finally, the post-mortem itself. Lots of figures that mean nothing to me, platelet counts and other blood work, followed by the comment, liver, normal. At the thought of some pathologist patiently removing her tiny little liver, my throat constricts. But there's more. Kidneys, normal. Lungs, normal. Heart, normal. I skip down to the summary. While an exact diagnosis is not possible at this stage, signs of placental thrombosis may point to a partial placenta abruptio, leading to death by asphyxiation. Placenta abruptio? It sounds like a Harry Potter spell, not something that could kill my baby. Dr. Gifford's name at the bottom of the page swims glassily as the tears spring to my eyes, and I start crying again, great gulping, snotty sobs I can't control. It's all too much to take in, and anyway, I don't understand most of the words. Tessa, the woman I share a desk with at the office, has a background in midwifery. I decide to take the letter to work so she can talk me through it. Tessa reads the letter carefully, giving me the occasional concerned look. She knows, of course, that I had a stillbirth. Many of the women who volunteer at Still Hope have a similar personal reason for doing so. Do you know what it all means? She says at last. I shake my head. Well, placenta abruptio is a ruptured placenta. Effectively, they're saying the fetus stopped getting nutrients and oxygen before you went in. Nice of them to use English, I say. Yes. Well, there may be a reason for that. Something about her voice makes me look at her. When you went in with back pain, she says slowly, what happened exactly? Well, I think back, they clearly thought I was being over-anxious first-time mother and all that, but they were very nice about it. I don't actually remember being given all those tests they talk about. A symphysis fundal height assessment is just medical speak for measuring the bump with a tape measure, she interrupts. And while it's true that it's a NICE guideline to do one at every prenatal visit, it's certainly not going to reveal a failing placenta. Did they do a cardiotocograph? The heart monitor thing? Yes, the nurse did that. Who did she show the trace to? I try to remember. I think she phoned Dr. Gifford and read the results to him, or at any rate told him they were normal. Any other scans? Regular ultrasound? Doppler? Tessa's voice has taken on a grim tone. I shake my head. They told me to go home, have a hot bath, and try not to worry. And I felt Isabel kicking later, so I realized they were right.
Who's they?
Well, the nurse, I suppose.
Did she speak to anyone else? A senior midwife? Resident?
Not that I recall. Tessa, what is this?
It's just that this letter reads to me like a carefully worded attempt to give you the impression there was no medical negligence involved in Isabel's death, she says bluntly.
I gape at her.
Negligence? How? If you start from the position that the death of a viable baby is a death that should have been avoided, then usually you find one of two things has caused it. First, a mismanaged birth. That obviously wasn't the case here. But the second most common cause of stillbirth is an overworked midwife or junior doctor failing to read a CTG trace correctly. In your case, the senior doctor on call should have reviewed the results himself and, given the back pain you reported, which can be an indication of problems with the placenta, ordered a Doppler scan.
I know about Doppler scans. One of Still Hope's campaign goals is for every expectant mother to receive one as a matter of course. It will cost about £15 per baby, and the fact the NHS currently doesn't do them unless a senior doctor specifically requests it is one of the reasons why stillbirth rates in the UK are among the worst in Europe. I'm afraid the kicking you felt after you went home may have been distress, not a sign everything was all right. We've got a history with this hospital. They're consistently understaffed, particularly at senior doctor level. Dr. Gifford's name comes up again and again. He basically has way too high a workload. The words are barely sinking in. But he was so nice, I think. Of course, you can argue that's not his fault, she adds. But it's only by going after the senior doctor and proving they failed the patient that will ever get the hospital to increase their staffing ratios. I remember Dr. Gifford telling me, even as he broke the news that Isabel was dead, that in the majority of cases, no cause was ever found. Was he trying to cover up for his team's mistakes even then? What should I do? She hands the letter back to me.
Write back, asking for a copy of all the medical records. We'll get them reviewed by an expert. But if it looks as if the hospital is covering up incompetence, we should think about litigation.
Then, Emma. And this year's Architects Journal Award for Innovation goes to... The presenter pauses dramatically and opens his envelope. The Monkford Partnership, he announces. Our table, made up of partnership staff, cheers. Images of buildings flash onto the screens. Edward gets up and makes his way to the stage, politely acknowledging a few well-wishers as he does so. This is nothing like the parties I went to at Simon's magazine, I'm thinking. When Edward has the award in his hand, he steps toward the microphone. I may have to put this in a cupboard, he says, looking down at the plexiglass blob doubtfully. Laughter. The minimalist has proved he can make fun of himself, but then he turns serious. Someone once said that the difference between a good architect and a great one is that the good architect gives in to every temptation and the great one does not. He pauses. There's silence around the huge room. They seem genuinely interested in what he has to say. As architects, we're obsessed with aesthetics, with creating buildings that are pleasing to the eye. But if we accept that the real function of architecture is to help people resist temptation, then perhaps architecture... He falters, almost as if he's thinking out loud. Perhaps architecture isn't really about buildings at all, he says. We accept that town planning is a kind of architecture after all. Motorway networks, airports, these too are to stretch. But what about technology? What about that invisible city in which we all stroll, or lurk, or play? The internet. What about the frameworks of our lives? the bonds that tie us, our aspirations and our baser desires. Are these not also structures, in a way? There's another pause before he continues. Earlier today, I was speaking to someone, a young woman who was attacked in her home. Her space was violated, her possessions were stolen. Her whole attitude to her surroundings has been coloured, I might almost say distorted, by that simple, tragic fact. He doesn't look at me, but I feel as if every person in the room must know who he means. Isn't the real function of architecture to make such a thing impossible? He asks. To punish the perpetrator, heal the victim, change the future. As architects, why should we stop at our building's walls? Silence. The audience seems quite baffled now. The Monkford Partnership is known as a practice that works on a small scale, with wealthy clients, he says. But I see now that our future lies not in building beautiful havens from the ugliness in society, but in building a different kind of society. He raises the award. Thank you for this honour. The applause is polite, but looking around I see people are smiling and rolling their eyes at one another. And I clap too, harder than anyone, because the man up there, my lover, doesn't give a damn whether they laugh at him or not. That night, I ask about his wife. I keep the dress on while we make love, but afterward I hang it carefully in the tiny cupboard behind the wall panel before slipping, naked except for the necklace, into the warm space beside him. The lawyer told me your family are buried here, I say tentatively. How? Oh. He goes, the land registry plans. He's silent for so long, I think that's all the answer I'm going to get. It was her idea, he says at last. She'd read about Hita Bashira and said that that was what she wanted if she died before me, under the threshold of one of our own buildings. Of course, we never imagined. Hita Bashira. It means human pillar in Japanese. It's said to bring the house good luck. You don't mind me talking about her? Look at me, he says with sudden seriousness, and I turn my head so I can see into his eyes. Elizabeth was perfect in her own way, he says gently. She's in the past now, and this is perfect too. What's happening right now, with us? You're perfect, Emma. We don't need to talk about her again. Next morning, after he's gone, I look his wife up on the internet, but housekeeper can't find anything. What was the Japanese word he used? Hitobashira. I try a search for that. I frown. According to the internet, Hitobashira doesn't refer to burying dead people under buildings. It's about burying the living. The custom of sacrificing a human being as part of the erection of a new house or fortress is very old. Foundation stones and beams were laid in human blood the world over, and this abominable custom was practiced but a few centuries ago in Europe. In the well-known Maori tradition of Taraya, we are told that he had his own child buried alive beneath a post of his new house. I jump to another article. This sacrifice must be in keeping with the importance of the building to be erected. An ordinary tent or house can be bought off with an animal, or a rich man's house with a slave, but a sacred structure, such as a temple or a bridge, needs a sacrifice of special worth and importance, one perhaps involving serious pain or discomfort to the one making it. For one crazy moment, I wonder if this is what Edward can mean. That he made a sacrifice of his own wife and son. And then I find another article that makes more sense. Today, the echo of such practices lives on in innumerable folk customs around the world. Sending off a ship with a bottle of champagne, burying a piece of silver under a doorpost, or topping out a skyscraper with the bough of an evergreen. In other parts, an animal heart is buried, while Henry Purcell chose to be interred under the organ at Westminster Abbey. In many societies, notably in the Far East, the dead are marked with a building constructed in their honour, A practice not so very different, perhaps, from the naming of a Carnegie Hall or a Rockefeller Plaza after some noted philanthropist. Phew. I go back to bed, burrowing my nose into the pillows for any trace of him, his smell, his shape still outlined in the sheets. His words come back to me. This is perfect. I drift back to sleep with a smile on my face.
Now, Jane.
What you experienced when you walked through the front door into a small, almost claustrophobic hallway before entering the flowing spaces of the house itself is a classic architectural device of compression and release. It's a good example of the way Edward Monkford's houses, though seemingly revolutionary, are based on traditional techniques. But more important, it marks Monkford out as an architect whose primary purpose is to affect the way the user feels.
The guide walks toward the kitchen, the gaggle of half a dozen visitors following him obediently.
Users have reported that in a refectory area such as this, for example, with its visual emphasis on austerity and restraint, they find themselves eating less than they did previously.
Camilla told me before I moved in that I'd be required to open One Folgate Street to visitors occasionally. Back then, it hadn't seemed a great hardship, but as the first open day approached, I found myself dreading it more and more. It wouldn't just be the house that was on display, I felt, but me. For days now, I've tidied and cleaned, careful not to infringe even the smallest rule.
Architects and their clients have long sought to create buildings with a sense of purpose, the guide continues. Banks look imposing and solid, partly because the men who commissioned them wanted to instill confidence in potential depositors. Courtrooms seek to impose respect for law and order. Palaces were designed to impress and humble those who entered them. But today, some architects are using new developments in technology and psychology to go far beyond that.
The guide is very young, with an overly fashionable beard, but I sense from his air of authority he's probably some kind of lecturer. Not all the visitors look as if they're students, though. Some could be curious neighbors or tourists.
You probably aren't aware of it, but you're currently swimming in a complex soup of ultrasonics, mood-enhancing waveforms. That technology is only in its infancy, but it has far-reaching implications. Imagine a hospital where the structure itself becomes part of the healing process, or a home for dementia sufferers that actually helps them to remember. This house might be simple, but its ambition is extraordinary.
He turns and leads the way toward the staircase.
Please follow me in single file, taking special care on the steps.
I stay downstairs. I can hear the guide's voice explaining how the lighting in the bedroom reinforces the user's circadian rhythms. Only when they come down again do I slip upstairs myself to get some privacy. With a shock, I realize one of the group is still in the bedroom. He's opened the cupboard, and although he has his back to me, I'm fairly sure he's looking through my clothes.
What the hell are you doing?
I demand. He turns around. It's one of the ones I'd taken for a tourist. His eyes, behind rimless spectacles, are pale and calm. I'm seeing how you fold your things. His voice is slightly accented, Danish perhaps, or Norwegian. About 30 years old, wearing a slightly military-looking anorak, fair, receding hair.
How dare you! I explode. Those are private!
No one who lives in this house should expect privacy. You signed that away, remember?
Who are you?
He sounds far too well-informed for a tourist. I applied, he says. I applied to live here,
7 times. I would be perfect for it, but he chose you instead.
He turns back to the cupboard and starts to unfold and refold my t-shirts as fast and neat as a shop assistant.
What does Edward see in you?
Sex, I suppose. Women are his weakness.
I am breathless with anger, but the realization that this man standing in my bedroom is almost certainly deranged has paralyzed me. He is inspired by monasteries and religious communities, but he forgets that women were excluded from those places for a reason.
He picks up a skirt and folds it in 3 deft movements.
Really, you should leave. It would be much better for Edward if you went, like the others.
What others? What are you talking about?
He gives me a smile of almost childish sweetness.
Oh, hasn't he told you?
The ones before.
None of them last, you see.
That's the whole point.
He was crazy, I say. Terrifying. And the way he spoke, it was as if he knew you.
Edward sighs.
I suppose he does, in a way. Or at least he thinks he does, because he knows the work.
We're sitting in the refectory area. Edward has brought wine, something exquisite and Italian. But I'm still a little shaky, and in any case, I haven't really been drinking since I moved to 1 Folgate Street.
Who is he?
At the office, they call him my stalker.
He smiles.
That's a joke, of course. He's actually quite harmless. Jorgen something.
He dropped out of an architecture degree with mental health problems and became slightly obsessed with my buildings.
It's not that uncommon. Barragan, Corbusier, Foster. They've all had disturbed individuals fixated on them, believing they have some special connection.
Have you told the police?
He shrugs.
What would be the point?
But Edward, don't you see what this means? When Emma Matthews died, did anyone ever check to see if this Jorgen person was around?
He gives me a wary look.
You're not still on about that, are you?
It happened right here. Of course I think about it.
Have you been talking to the boyfriend again?
Something about the way he says it suggests he wouldn't be pleased if I had. I shake my head.
He hasn't been back.
Good. And believe me, Jorgen wouldn't hurt anyone.
He takes another mouthful of wine, then bends down to kiss me. His lips are sweet and bloody with grape.
Edward, I say, pulling away.
Yes?
Were Emma and you lovers?
Does it make a difference?
No, I say. Of course, I mean yes.
We had a brief affair, he says at last. It was over long before she died.
Was it?
I don't know how to ask this.
Was it like this?
He comes very close to me, holding my head in both hands, fixing me with his gaze.
Listen to me, Jane. Emma was a fascinating person, he says gently. But she's in the past now. What's happening right now, with us? This is perfect. We don't need to talk about her again.
Despite his words, there's an itch of curiosity I can't quite satisfy. Because I know that when I know more about the women he's loved, I'll understand him better. I will tunnel beneath the walls he's erected around himself, the strange, invisible labyrinth that keeps me at a distance. Next morning, after he's gone, I hunt out the card I found in Emma's sleeping bag. Carol Janssen, accredited psychotherapist. There's a website as well as a phone number. I'm about to look it up on my laptop
when I recall what the man in my bedroom said. No one who lives in this house should expect privacy. You signed that away, remember? I take my phone and walk to the extreme corner of the sitting room, where I pick up a faint trace of a neighbor's unsecured Wi-Fi, just enough for me to connect to Carol Janssen's website. She has a diploma in something called integrative psychotherapy, and her specialties are listed as post-traumatic stress, rape counseling, and bereavement. I call the number. Hello, I say when a woman answers. I recently suffered a bereavement. I was wondering if I could come and see you about it.
6. A person close to you confesses in confidence that they ran someone over while drunk. As a result, they've given up drinking for good. Would you feel obliged to report it to the police? Report or don't report?
Then, Emma. Watching Edward getting ready to cook is like watching a surgeon preparing to operate. Everything neatly laid out in its correct place before he even starts. Today he's brought 2 lobsters, still alive, their big boxing glove claws cuffed with cable ties. I ask for a job and am given a daikon, a heavy Japanese radish, to grate. He's cheerful tonight. I'm hoping it's from being with me, but then he says he's had some good news. That speech I made at the AJ Awards, Emma. Someone who heard it has asked us to submit designs for a competition. Is it a big one? Very. If we win, we'll be building a whole new town. It's a chance to do what I was talking about, to design more than just buildings, a new kind of community, perhaps. A whole town like this, I say, looking at the stark minimalism of 1 Folgate Street. Why not? I just can't believe most people would want to live like this, I say. I don't tell him that whenever he comes to the house, I still frantically rush around, pushing dirty clothes into cupboards, scraping half-eaten plates of food into the trash, and hiding magazines and newspapers under the sofa cushions. You're the proof it can work, he says. An ordinary person who's been changed by architecture. I've been changed by you, I say. And I don't think even you can have sex with an entire town. He's brought some Japanese tea to go with the lobster. The leaves come in a tiny paper wrap like an origami puzzle. From the Uji region, he says. The tea's name is Jokoro, which means jewel dew. I try to pronounce it and he corrects me several times before giving up in pretend disgust. His reaction when I produce my Art Deco teapot, however, is anything but pretend. What on earth is that? He says, frowning at it. It was my birthday present from Simon. Don't you like it? I suppose it'll do the job. He leaves the tea to infuse while he deals with the lobsters. Taking a knife, he slips the blade under the armored helmets. Moments later, there's a cracking sound as he twists the heads away. The legs continue to twitch as he gets to work on the tails, slicing down each side. The meat slides out easily, a fat column of pale gristle. A few more movements and he's removed the brown skin, rinsing the tails again under cold water before cutting them into sashimi. A dipping sauce made from lemon juice, soy, and rice vinegar is the final touch. The whole assembly only takes a few minutes. We eat with chopsticks, then one thing leads to another and we end up in bed. I almost always come before him, and tonight is no exception. By design, I suspect. Our lovemaking is as carefully thought out as everything else he does. I wonder what would happen if I could make him lose control. What revelations or hidden truths lie beyond this rigid self-restraint? One day, I decide, I'll find out. Afterward, as I'm drifting off, I hear him murmur, "You're mine now, Emma. You know that, don't you? Mine." I say sleepily. "Yours." I wake to find him no longer beside me. Padding to the top of the stairs, I see he's down in the refectory area tidying up. Still hungry, I set off to join him. I'm halfway down when I see him pick up Simon's teapot and carefully pour the remains of the tea into the sink. Then there's a crash, and the teapot's in pieces all over the floor. I must make a sound because he looks up. "I'm so sorry, Emma," he says calmly. He holds up his hands. "I should have dried these first." I go to help, but he stops me. "Not in bare feet. You'll cut yourself." "Of course, I'll replace it," he adds. "There's a good one by Marimekko Haneke, or the Bauhaus is still very fine." I go into the kitchen anyway, crouching down and picking up the broken pieces. "It doesn't matter," I say. "It's only a teapot." "Well, exactly," he says reasonably. "It's only a teapot." And I feel a strange little thrill of satisfaction, of being owned. "You're mine."
Now, Jane. Carol Janssen is based in a quiet, leafy street in Queen's Park. When she opens the door, she gives me a strange, almost startled look, then quickly recovers and ushers me through to a sitting room. Directing me to the sofa, she explains that this will just be an exploratory session to see if she can help me. If we decide to go ahead, we'll meet at the same time each week. "So," she says, when these preliminaries are out of the way, "what brings you to therapy at this time, Jane?" "Well, several things," I say. "The stillbirth I mentioned on the phone, primarily." Carol nods. "Talking about our feelings of grief gives us a way to sort through them, to begin the process of separating the necessary emotions from the destructive ones. Anything else?" "Yes, I think you may have treated someone I have a connection with. I'd like to know what was troubling her." Carol Janssen shakes her head firmly. "I can't ever discuss my other clients." "I think it might be different in this case. You see, she's dead. Her name was Emma Matthews." I can't be mistaken. The look in Carol Janssen's eyes is definitely shock. But she quickly recovers. "I still can't tell you what Emma and I talked about. A client's right to confidentiality doesn't end at her death." "Is it true that I look a bit like her?" She hesitates for a moment before nodding. "Yes, I noticed it as soon as I opened the door. You're a relative, I take it. Her sister. I'm sorry." I shake my head. "We never met." She looks puzzled. "Then what's the connection, if you don't mind my asking?" "I live in the same house as her, the house where she died." Now it's my turn to hesitate. "And I'm having a relationship with the same man." "Simon Wakefield," she says slowly. "Her boyfriend?" "No, although I have met him when he came to leave some flowers. The man I'm talking about is the architect who built the house." Carol stares at me. "Let me make sure I have this straight. You're living in 1 Folgate Street, just as Emma did, and you're Edward Monkford's lover, just as Emma was." "That's right." Edward had talked about his relationship with Emma as if it had been little more than a brief affair. But I decide not to lead the witness. "In that case, I will tell you what Emma and I discussed in therapy, Jane," she says quietly. "Despite what you said just now," I say, rather surprised to have won so easily. "Yes. You see, there is one special circumstance in which we're allowed to break our professional duty of confidentiality." She pauses. "Where it can do no harm to the client, but may prevent harm from coming to someone else."
I don't understand, I say. What harm? And to who?
I'm talking about you, Jane, she says. I believe you may be in danger.
Then, Emma. Dion Nelson stole my happiness, I say. He shattered my life and made me afraid of every man I meet. He made me feel ashamed of my own body. I pause and take a drink from a glass of water. The courtroom is very quiet. Up on the bench, the two magistrates, a man and a woman, watch me unblinkingly. It's very hot. The room windowless and beige, the lawyers perspiring a little under their wigs. Two screens have been rigged up so that I can't be seen from the dock. I can feel Dion Nelson's presence behind them. But I don't feel scared. Quite the opposite. The bastard's going to prison. I've been crying, but now I raise my voice. I had to move because I thought he might come back, I say. I suffered flashbacks and memory loss, and I started seeing a counselor. My relationship with my boyfriend broke down. Nelson's lawyer, a short, trim woman wearing an elegant little power suit under her black gown, looks up, suddenly thoughtful, and makes a note. How do I feel about the prospect of Dion Nelson getting bail? I say. I feel sickened. Having been threatened at knife point by him, having been robbed and raped by him in the most humiliating way possible, I know what he's capable of. The idea that he could be